I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Sue Rowe is a biographer with a strong interest in the visual arts, and she has studied the work and life of Pablo Picasso for a long time. Her new book, Hidden Portraits, chronicles the lives of six of the most important women in Picasso's life: Fernand, Olga, Marie-Thérèse, Dora, Françoise, and Jacqueline, many of whom had successful careers of their own. I recently spoke with Sue Rowe about the book and the deep dive she took into the lives of each of these women. Here's our conversation. So in Hidden Portraits, you introduce readers to, as mentioned in the subtitle, six women who shaped Picasso's life. And these weren't the only women involved with Picasso. I'd like to touch on the specifics of why each of these women made the cut in a moment. But generally speaking, what was it about these women collectively that made you want to explore their lives?
Yes, indeed. Well, they were all women who had significant relationships with Picasso. Well, first they fell in love with him, they lived with him, they shared his life, they did sit for him, but that was by no means all they did. With three of them, he had his four children. So they were very, very important women to Picasso, and he was very important to them.
So let's look at these women individually. First, we have Fernand. Talk to me about her.
Okay, Fernand met Picasso when they were both very young. They met in Montmartre. Picasso first came to Montmartre in Paris, of course, when he was only 19. And he tried to make his way in the cheapest, most artistic, most bohemian district of Paris. But even Picasso had to go back home to Barcelona after about 3 years because he just couldn't support himself. No one wanted to buy his work. And when he came back in about 1904, he met Fernand, who by then was living in the same tumble-down building of so-called studios. He met her there, and they were kind of young together, and they fell in love, and they rattled around Montmartre, and they drank in the bars, and they went to the street markets, and they went to the circus. And it, for both of them, that was the youthful romance.
And then we have Olga.
Well, Olga was quite extraordinary. Olga was a dancer in Diaghilev's Ballet Russe company, the avant-garde company, even today very, very well known. And she was born in Ukraine. When her parents moved from Ukraine, she stayed behind. And she followed a friend of hers to St. Petersburg, where she joined the same ballet school. She wanted to learn to be a professional dancer. And when Diaghilev and Nijinsky together came auditioning at Olga's ballet school, Nijinsky picked her out to join Diaghilev's troupe. So she must have been pretty good. And they were rehearsing in Rome in 1917 for a show called Parade when she met Picasso, who was there as Diaghilev's set designer and costume designer. So they met as artists, if you like, fellow artists working on the same show. So it was a very creative relationship from the start. And Diaghilev noticed Picasso's interest in Olga. And he said to him, you know, don't you, that if you want a Russian woman, you have to marry her. So Picasso did. And they married in Paris in 1918. Shortly afterwards, just tragically, Olga sustained an injury to her leg, which prevented her from ever dancing again. But she was happy in her social set, which were all theatricals and dancers and, you know, the whole Parisian set of white Russians in Paris, and very, very happy to be Madame Picasso.
So then we go on to Marie-Thérèse. Talk to me about her.
Marie-Thérèse was a very unexpected relationship with Picasso. He met her when she was only 17. She was quite an independent, unusual 17-year-old who had made her way from the banlieues, where she lived on the outskirts of Paris, on the metro on a Saturday afternoon to go shopping at the Galeries Lafayette. And she was just going into the Galeries Lafayette when she noticed this charismatic, magnetic looking man with, or she always remembered, a really stunning red and black tie standing on the pavement outside the Galeries Lafayette. And she was completely struck by him, as he was by her. And he wandered over and he said, Mademoiselle, I would like to paint you. I am Picasso. And this meant absolutely nothing to Marie-Thérèse, who knew nothing about painting and was never interested in painting. But she fell in love with Picasso, and Picasso said, I wonder if you'd like to have lunch with me. Could we maybe meet in 2 or 3 days' time, on Monday at the metro station at the Gare Saint-Lazare? And when he went to the metro station, there she was waiting for him. And it was a very, very powerful love affair that lasted a long time. And they had a daughter together.
She was the only blonde, wasn't she?
Oh, was she the only blonde? Perhaps she was. Perhaps she was. I mean, no, she was blonde because although Picasso never painted traditional portraits in the traditional way, he used the idea of, or his memory, or his experience of a woman as a kind of starting point to continue his experiment, his ongoing experiment in paint, which was with the female figure. But the very curvaceous, very bouncy, wonderful, luscious pictures inspired by Marie-Thérèse always have yellow hair. So, those are the ones inspired by Marie-Thérèse. Yes.
And then the next woman is Dora. Talk to me about her.
Yes, Dora Maar. Well, Dora was a very standout person in Picasso's life and in many people's lives. By the time she met him, she was already a professional photographer with a reputation. She had, in her 20s, set up a photography studio and company with a friend of hers. At first, she photographed commercial shots of fashion, perfumes, shampoos, they were always slightly out of the ordinary. She was always sort of both photographing women to sell products and also noticing how women are photographed to sell products. So you're kind of somehow aware of that when you look at these photographs. They're very sort of subtly unusual. And then she went to Barcelona and she photographed the poor in the street after the 1929 crash, when there were people begging, there were people down and out, there were young boys with attitude leaning against walls with falling down socks. And she photographed the people who had been left destitute after the 1929 crash with great, great respect and empathy. And you can absolutely feel that in those photographs. And for me personally, I think that's Dora's most powerful work. But she continued her commercial photography. She continued to experiment. She got her own studio with a dark room. And she had been recognized by the second wave surrealists who invited her to exhibit. She had done all of this by the time she met Picasso. So when he met her, they worked together in her studio and in his studio. And in 1937, she worked with him on perhaps the most well-known painting by Picasso, which is Guernica. She photographed every stage of his work on that incredible painting. For 10 years, she went around and about with him. She met his friends. She mixed in his artistic circles. And then, after they parted, he bought her a very leaky house in the south of France, which seemed to have running water everywhere, but it had a large studio. And she resumed her own painting from that point, and on she went.
So next is Françoise.
These were all very strong, fundamentally independent women who had all made their own way and made their own presence felt in one way or another by the time they met Picasso. Françoise had studied art. She had also been studying law at the Sorbonne. So again, no ordinary woman. This was in the early 40s. She was studying at the Sorbonne. And her parents were dead against her giving up her law studies to focus on her painting. So she used to sneak off in the mornings and take lessons from a painter she knew and work in his studio. And she continued her art. He met her in a cafe, saw her across a crowded room, and true Picasso style, he just happened to have a bowl of cherries, and he took them over to her. And she was on a table with other friends, and he just sat down and got talking to them. And soon, he invited her to his studio, and she went to his studio. And I think she posed for him and he fell in love with her. But it took her 3 years to agree to move in with him because she always thought, well, I'm not going to really be making my way as a painter, standing side by side, each of us at our easels with the world's most famous painter. He's going to overshadow me. So she was living with her grandmother at the time. She was quite happy living with grandmother. And she said to him, look, I've got my freedom. I live with grandmother. I can come and go as I wish. I have a studio in her house. Why do we need to live together? I can come to your studio whenever I want to. And it took him 3 years of persuasion to persuade her to move in with him, which she then did.
But then she was the one who left him.
Yes, oh yes. Eventually, after 10 years, she had two children with him. She began to work again on her drawings and then her paintings. And they moved to a small house in the south of France, which was quite a cramped little house in the south of France. He never sort of felt motivated to move from there. So she felt quite sort of stymied in this house. And eventually, too much tension, too much friction. And they started to have arguments. And he said to her, just to sort of goad her, he said, well, I expect you're planning to leave me. And she said, well, so what if I am? And he said, no one leaves a man like me. So she proved him wrong. But before he said, okay, all right, fine, go. But before you go, can you just open the next bullfight on horseback? So she did. In she came on horseback, looking terribly glamorous, opened the bullfight, and then left. Yeah.
Okay, and so then finally we have Jacqueline.
Jacqueline, yes. I mean, I got very, very fond of them all. I'm always asked, who is your favorite? And I always say, when I was doing the research and starting the writing, whichever I was working on was my favorite. I got to Françoise, so she's my favorite now. And then I got to Jacqueline. But they're all fantastic in very different ways. And I think that's another thing that's quite interesting about them. They're all very different women. Jacqueline was, again, she had had a whole life by the time she was 27. She met Picasso. She was already divorced. She already had a 5-year-old daughter. She was married very young. Her husband was, I think, an engineer. He was posted to Africa. So she went and lived in Africa with him and their baby daughter. She lived in Africa for 5 years and had a child and got divorced by the time she met Picasso back in the south of France. So she was a very capable, capable woman. And she got herself a job in the local ceramics shop, which had a ceramic studio attached. And at the time, Picasso had become interested in ceramics and how he might, find different ways of painting ceramics. So he used to drop into the shop and chat to Jacqueline. And he started turning up with a red rose. And after a while, he moved in with her. And she spent the longest time with Picasso. She was with him for 20 years until his death. from his 70 to, he was about 71 till 91, and she, much younger, obviously, took great care of him, and helped to make sure that in his later years he was painting as devotedly and as vigorously as before. And one of the things that helped him do that was she helped Picasso keep people away from the house to minimize interruptions. She did it to help him, and she was full of spirit and life. She bought him a television, and he watched his favorite program on it, which was a program called Catch, which was a combination of boxing and clowning. He loved Catch, so he used to watch it on his television. She bought a projector so that she could project his favorite old master's paintings onto the wall of the sitting room. And the few friends who were welcomed would sit around in the evenings and discuss painting with him. And she taught him to dance. There's a wonderful photograph of her looking very chic in her short white shorts and her sleeveless blouse, teaching Picasso to dance. So she was full of life and warmth, I think. Yeah.
So can we talk about process for a moment? Because I kept thinking about the many different lives you explored, and I find myself wondering, how did you begin to attack this project? How did you approach the research?
Well, my first thought was that I knew a lot about Picasso because I've written two books before in which he plays a central part, In Montmartre and In Montparnasse. And Picasso is a big figure in those. So I knew my Picasso, and I had read just about every biography of Picasso, of which there are many, and many art history books about Picasso, of which there are many. And most of his biographers sort of mention the women, but they don't do much more than that. And I found myself wondering, with every new book on Picasso that I read, how, what about these women? Who were they? Where did he meet them? What were they like? So I began with no agenda other than to find out about them, just to find out about them. So I read a lot of catalogues, exhibition catalogues, in which you will find little pieces by various experts, and things turn up in those. I read memoirs of Picasso by his friends and everything I could find. And all the art history books, again, looking for pieces about the women. And I worked in the British Library, I worked in art libraries, in every exhibition of Picasso's work. I'm looking for little tidbits of information about them. I read everything they wrote. Luckily for us, Françoise Gillot wrote her own memoirs, Life with Picasso. So I was able to sort of delve into that for little anecdotes, of which there are some absolutely charming anecdotes. And Fernande, the first one, wrote her journals. I'd read those in English, so I went to the British Library and got it in French, and just made sure I wasn't missing anything by reading it in English. So, what else did I look at? Oh, it's funny. Once your eye is open and you know what you're looking for, suddenly it seems to be everywhere. And you go from thinking, where will I ever find out enough, to thinking, what am I going to do with this vast mountain of material?
So while you examine the six significant women throughout the book, you also explain some of Picasso's portraits of these women, noting details like the composition and color palette and style of the images. And it did inspire me to go look at some of these portraits so I could get a glimpse of how they were viewed. So how much familiarity did you have with these works of art before you started the book? And did they change how you viewed the women, or maybe did they change how you viewed Picasso?
I had quite a familiarity because what I tend to do is, I mean, in a way, the paintings are your primary material. We're talking about works of art here. That's the starting point. And then the women in the works of art, and then who were the women? I will stand in a gallery and just look and look and look and take notes. There was a recent really good Picasso exhibition with Paul Smith's designs and Picasso's paintings at the Musée Picasso. And there were some lovely pictures of Marie-Thérèse there and some lovely photographs of Françoise. How did it change? I think the other starting point for me, in a way, was way before I started seriously researching women's lives. I began by thinking, I wonder what it felt like to be a muse, what it felt like to model for Picasso. And we know they all did model for him. But actually, I discovered that their lives were far, far, far more than the short periods in which they modeled for him. They were his muses in the sense that Picasso had a great memory. I mean, if a woman sat in front of him, he could memorize her presence and paint any number of paintings from, remembering that moment. He also painted more than we realize from photographs. The so-called reversion to classicism. He had a short period of painting Olga in a much more classical style. And those paintings were painted, there's only one or two of them, were painted to celebrate their engagement and their marriage. And they were painted from photographs. So, no, I don't ever think I can really learn anything about the women's lives from the paintings. Can I learn anything about the paintings from the women's? Well, there are certain moments in the lives of these women. For example, when Olga was unable to be in touch with her family in Russia after the revolution, didn't know if her father was alive or dead. Suddenly, some letters started getting through. She received these very sad letters from her mother begging her to come to Russia, which of course was impossible at that time. And Picasso drew her reading letters and looking melancholy. And, I think I came across some art historical moment where the art historian had said, she was obviously becoming very sort of miserable with Picasso. No. So it's very easy to make mistakes and make assumptions. And then, I mean, another example is Fernand, who really initiated his rose period. He painted her nude and he painted her while she was asleep, and he painted her in very simplified forms in his new rose palette, which was sort of rose and earth colors, and she inspired that. But then when you look at the figure he always said was Fernand in the Demoiselles d'Avignon, that's a very different figure. So he never looked at a woman in one way and painted the definitive portrait.
I appreciate that Picasso takes a bit of a backseat role in this book, and as the narrative focuses on the perspectives of these six women. Was it challenging to write such a book without him dominating the narrative? Did he ever threaten to take over?
No, I can safely say no, because I was very consciously writing each woman's story from her point of view. So of course he's a central figure in each of their lives because they were all in love with him, and they were, I'm writing about their relationships with him. But no, I was never tempted to think, oh, let's just ditch these women and write about Picasso. No. And also because, some of them were artists in their own right. Françoise became, particularly after she left Picasso, a very, very interesting and inspiring painter. And of course, Dora's work is absolutely fascinating. Olga was a ballerina. There was plenty to learn about them. So I could just sort of feel him in my psyche going, oh, okay, then, you let them take over.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from this book?
I hope that a reader will think, wow, we always knew Picasso had lots of relationships with women, but we didn't know how significant his relationships with these particular six women were. And also, actually, hey, yeah, it's true. We knew virtually nothing about them. And here are these absolutely fascinating women who would all each have been fascinating almost without having a relationship with Picasso. They are six very fabulous stories about women's strength, independence, imagination, style. I hope that people will be inspired by all of these women. And I think they are, because I love the question, who is your favorite? Because they're all my favorite, I turn it back on the questioner and say, who's your favorite? And everybody who's read the book has got a favorite. So, you know, I think people are connecting with it, which is lovely.
Well, the book is Hidden Portraits, Six Women Who Shaped Picasso's Life. Sue Rowe, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much indeed.
Hidden Portraits, Six Women Who Shaped Picasso's Life was published by W.W. Norton. Ready for another dystopian nightmare? Up next, book critic Suzanne Perez says a new novel explores the dark side of population control.
Grace Walker's debut novel, The Merge, opens in a world where Earth's resources have been pushed to a breaking point. That has given rise to a controversial new procedure in which two people's consciousness can be combined and exist in one body. This experimental merge is seen as an answer to overpopulation and possibly even a cure for things like cancer, dementia, and drug abuse. And here is where we meet Lori and Amelia. Lori is 65 and living with Alzheimer's, and her daughter Amelia can't bear the thought of her mother's mind fading away. So Amelia signs them up to take part in the world's first experimental merging process for Alzheimer's patients. While preparing for the process, they get to know a group of other merge participants. Ben plans to merge with his pregnant fiancée, Annie. Teenage Lucas plans to merge with his terminally ill brother, Noah. And Jay will join with his 17-year-old daughter, Laura, who is a recovering addict. Walker creates a world where the radical procedure is almost believable, backed by billionaire investors and governments that offer powerful incentives to consider merging. So-called combines get access to the best housing, health care, and other resources, while those who defy the coexistence procedure must pay higher taxes and barely scrape by for food and other necessities. The original and intriguing premise sets The Merge apart from the slew of other dystopian novels out there. But the pace is agonizingly slow, at least during the novel's first half, when Lori and Amelia are learning about the procedure and considering its potential effects. We get occasional flashbacks to their lives before entering the experiment, including Amelia's romantic relationship and her history of being an anti-merge activist, and Lori's traumatic childhood. We also catch brief glimpses of the corporate structure that launched what Lori views as societal cleansing, but nothing that comes close to explaining why a majority of citizens would go along with it. When Lori and Amelia move to The Village, which is a plush rehabilitation center for those who have merged, the plot takes a decidedly darker turn. Amelia and her mother gain insight into some of the corrupt machinations behind the merge, and, no surprise here, the system isn't quite as optimal as it seems. The novel does raise some valuable discussion points, including how far you'd be willing to go to save a loved one and never have to say goodbye. Other themes include the dangers of corporate influence and the ethics of medical advancement. And as with many modern dystopian stories, the hypothetical here doesn't seem too far away from our current reality. Walker creates a vivid new world and memorable characters, and her depiction of Lori's Alzheimer's is painfully realistic. There are also some noteworthy twists and a remarkable, if not totally satisfying, resolution. All in all, a worthwhile addition to the dystopian roster. For Marginalia, I'm Suzanne Perez.
The Merge by Grace Walker was published by HarperCollins. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Lou Ann Stevens. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.